Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Ted Vavam and Aleph, sixth line down. Rav Ashi here is giving an alternate answer. So far we saw the answers of Rava and Rabba bar Rav Huna about how to explain the Braita. Rava said, Achav Ma'eskinek Shagorun Kazal Chmichaviro Sadem Lea Peirot. It's a question if that's the Girsa. V'chalate Peirot V'char Chafar Barbarot Shichim Umearot. Because of that, or the claim for the land itself, you could take from Nichasim Mishubadim, but that which from the Peirot can only be taken from Bnei Chorin. Rabbi Rav Huna says it's a case of Mesikim, who came and took away the land, stole the land from him, but it was because of him, because of the Gazlan, that it was stolen. And therefore, again, for the Karen, you can take from Nichasim Mishubadim, but from the Peirot, you can only take from Nichasim Bnei Chorin. That's what we left off yesterday. So then Rav Ashi Amar Litzdadim Ktani, that the Braita is actually two different cases. Both Rova and Rabbi Rav Huna's case, they say there's a single event or a single claim that bifurcates into a din of Karen, which comes from Nechasim Mishubadim, even from encumbered properties, and another din of Peirot, which only comes from free and clear property. What Rav Ashi does instead is says there are just two cases over here, which is Kagom, Shegazal Sadeh Mechaviro Mlea Peirot, stole the land full of Peirot, Vachalat HaPeirot, and then he ate the Peirot, Umacharat HaSadeh, and sold the field. Balokeach Ligvot Karen, the buyer who wants to get his money back for this field that he bought that wasn't really the Gazlan's to sell, then he gets his Karen, Govem Nechasim Mishubadim. He can go make a claim and get his money back even from encumbered property. But Nigzal the Gavot Peirot, the one who was stolen from, wants to get his Peirot, Goveh minichasim bnei chorin. He can only go after free and clear property. So now, both Rava and Rabbo explain the case as being a single incident or a single event. We saw yesterday that they each didn't hold of each other because there was a deficit in their explanations. Rava's explanation as a deficit because it says, Yotza mitachat yado, which Rabba bar Huna says means the end, the same way the field went into his hand. That's what Beit Din is confiscating it away with, or in his case, the Mesikim are taking it away. And for Rava, Rabba bar Huna's explanation had a deficit, which was the fact that it says Yotze Mitachat Yado, which sounds like from Beit Din is confiscating it and not some third party that's taking it away. So both of them had a deficit in their explanation. So Rav Ashi solves that problem and doesn't use either of their explanations in a full sense. So he comes up with a scenario in which this is true, and it conforms to both of their explanations of Yotza Mitachat Yado, that it's Beit Din that's confiscating it, as well as the fact that the land is going back intact. It wasn't ruined or destroyed in the interim. But the obvious deficit in Rav Ashi's explanation is that he explains the case as dealing with two different parties, which is not really obvious from the Braita. The Braita sounds like it's one party, and a certain claim he'll pay with encumbered property, another claim you will pay with only free and clear property. What he did was say, there's two different claimants over here. And those two different claimants then have different rights of collection. The koneh, the buyer of the property from the person who stole it, he has a right to get his karen, his principal back, at least from nechasim mishubadim, from the encumbered property. On the other hand, the nigzal, who had the property stolen from him and lost his peirot, his peirot he only can get from free and clear property, not from encumbered property. But in explaining it that way, it solves the problem as to why it's not a question on those that believe that alokeach min hagazlan is not entitled to shevach. And we explain the Braita in any of these manners, whether it's according to Rav or according to Rabbi bar Huna, according to Rav Ashi, so that it's no longer a question on Shmuel's position that keach min hagazlan is not entitled to the shevach from the Gazlan. So now the Gemara continues and says, Ben the Rava, Ben the Rabba bar Huna, Milva alpehu. Why is there any right of collection here from encumbered property? There is only what we call a milva alpeh. There's only a loan that is done orally, because they both say that the gviata karen is coming from the Gazlan, that the one who was stolen from is going to collect from the Gazlan. And over there, what right of collection he has is only because he was stolen from, but there's no documented transaction between them because it was stolen. And if it's stolen, now we're talking about an oral transaction. That oral transaction does not entitle you to go after encumbered property. Remember, again, the reason that you can go after encumbered property when you have a shtar is because the edin that signed on the shtar give it a kol, and it's the equivalent of putting it into the registry, making it public that there is a title change over here, and then people know what has happened. But in a case where it's done al peh, then how does anybody else know that information? So to here, where the gazlan takes the nigzal's property, there's nothing that gives subsequent buyers any indication that there's a risk that sits in front of them, because they don't know about the transaction. So if they weren't aware of the transaction, how is it that you can go after their property? Or how come the nigzal can go after these buyers' property, the encumbered property, when they had no idea that he had a prior claim to them? And that's the basic thesis, that if it's an oral loan, you can't go after encumbered property. It says, "Achmaiskinan b'shamad b'din." He already was bin beitin v'hader zovin, and then he sold it. So after there was already the claim against him, then he sold the property. So beitin already wrote a verdict that incriminated him or indicated that he owed the money from this theft. Then he sold property. So now here there's a clear lien against him because Beit Din's verdict is a written document, a shtar, which should be of public nature. And it's the equivalent of already having if you did a title search, this should come up, because this is well known or well publicized. And that's it. As she says, came into Chayvua Beit Din Itlei Kala. Since Beit Din obligated him, then that has public, or becomes public knowledge. It's the equivalent of a milveh b'shtar. Tosafot over here says about Kusha Amad Madin, he says, Tema, imkein mai b'pnei tikkun olam. The whole braitot were premised on a Mishnah in Gittin that says the reason that we don't allow you to collect for peirot, mazon, and all these unlimited items is because of mipnei tikkun olam. Over here, once Beit Din gives a verdict, you have a quantified amount of what he owes over here. So then why should it be that you need mipnei tikkun olam? Tikkun olam is no longer relevant. The reason is, kusha amad b'din. Yesh lamar, idalav mipnei tikkun olam, havamina ho v'amad b'din ala keren, yesh kol gam l'peirot. So he says that had it not been for the tikkun olam, I would have assumed that whatever's true of the principal amount of land is also true of the peirot. The tikkun olam comes along and says that they're separate obligations. And since they're separate obligations, you only have what's covered by the verdict of Beit Din is the keren, the principal amount, that is a kol. The peirot are not covered by that verdict, and therefore they're not considered to be a public information. When it says, iachi peirot nami. So when it says, if that's the case, there was already a verdict in Beit Din, then why can't he collect the peirot also from encumbered property? He also has a shtar on that amount that is owed also. Kishamad b'din ala keren, v'lomad b'din ala peirot. It's a case where he took him to court about the principal amount, but has yet to make the claim about the peirot. Interesting, difficult to understand, yes. Because why wouldn't he have just brought the case together? Because they're the same parties and the same claim that's going on. But here the Gemara says that he did them separately, and he's only made the claim vis-a-vis the keren, the principal amount, and Beit Din gave him a verdict there. The peirot has yet to adjudicate the case. Gemara asks, my Pascha, how do you know that? Why would you assume that a breita has a situation in which he went to din on this and not on that? Where's that information available or obvious out of the breita? Says Stama de Milta. Says that's the default scenario. Kitava inish karna tava bereisha. When people make a claim, they make a claim for the principal amount first, and then they go after the peirot. If the person wants the principal amount back, he wants to ensure that he doesn't have losses. Now, the opportunity lost or the profits that were there, that he'll go after afterwards. So the idea being that in terms of hierarchy of returned capital, he'd like his principal amount back, and then he'll figure out how he can get more. But at least he wants his principal amount back. So he, again, would bring it as a first case on the principal and then a second case of peirot, and that's the scenario in the breita. Even though, again, it would seem to make more sense to bring the whole case in one shot, Gemara sees him separating out the issues. Where it says, Vishavar Shmuel ukach migazlan leit leishvacha. Our assumption is that Shmuel's position is that you do not get shevach when you purchase from the gazlan, which was the machloket that we saw between Rav and Shmuel before. Vishamukha sadel chavirov nimtzei cheinu shalo. Rav says you get ma'ot and you get shevach. And Shmuel says you get your money back, but you don't get the shevach back. So the Gemara says, does Shmuel really believe that when you purchase property from a gazlan, that you don't get any shevach? You get no return of that additional investment that you made there? V'amar le Shmuel, the Rav Chinina bar Shilat, imlich. Rav Chinina bar Shilat, who's a sofer, he says, check with the parties on the following issues. V'katov, and then you can write the shtar. Shofra, shvacha, upere. Two of these items we actually had on the previous amud, which is there too. We had the memra from Shmuel that said, shevach, shefer, v'shibud. Tzarichli malech. Those three things you have to check. So now, in our case, we have the shvacha again, we have the shefer again, but now we have the peirot that are added in. So now the questions are the following. The way Rashi explained them was shefer is, do you want him to be able to collect from idit? Is he allowed to collect from the best property rather than the default of beinonit, of a middle range property? The shevach, do you want recourse for the shevach to be written into the document? The buyer has recourse against the seller for the shevach, not just for the principal amount. And then we have peirot. Does he have, again, a right of recourse with regards to peirot? And the last thing is shibud. You want to have recourse at all. Do you want to be on the hook for whatever you sold? So in the end, what Rashi says is there are actually four items. There are four questions that he asks. Three here, three before. If you put them together, since in each of the sets of three, there's one that changed, you now have four items that you're asking him. And that's what Rashi says over here. Shata kotev shtar himalech b'mocher im yikabel olav lagbot l'lokeach mishefer nechasav. Do you allow him to go back after you against the idit property? Karna ushvacha opere. The principal amount, the shevach, and the peirot. If they're taken away from him, does he have a right of recourse? So here Rashi mentions four things. The truth is that they're all revolving around one item, is does he allow recourse? Once he allows recourse, how does the recourse work? Does he have recourse against your best property? Does he have recourse for shevach? Does he have recourse for the peirot? Shmuel says over here that you have recourse. But my, what is the scenario here? If you're talking about a creditor that is coming and taking the property away from the buyer, and now the buyer is going back to the debtor because of that recourse, mi itle pere. We said before that a baal chov that confiscates the property, there is no peirot for the creditor. Vamar Shmuel, baal chov gova et ha-shevach, shevachin aval peirot lo. A baal chov, a creditor, does not have a right to confiscate peirot, because peirot are things that came onto the property after the fact. They're not what are called shevach memeilo. And therefore, he doesn't have rights to those peirot because they don't necessarily belong to the land or connected to the land. So therefore, when the creditor comes, he takes the property, he doesn't get the peirot. And Shmuel explicitly says, b'chol govet ha-shevach, that he is able to take the shevach, the value added to the property, shevachin aval peirot lo. When it comes to shevach, he's allowed to take that or confiscate that from the buyer, but he's not allowed to take the peirot. So how do you explain Shmuel's statement where he's asking in a contract, do you want recourse for shevach? Where is the scenario? El alav b'lokeach mi gazlan. It must be a scenario in which he bought it from a gazlan, and that's why he has recourse here, or we need to know about the recourse. Because there are only two reasons that you're going to lose the property or have it confiscated. Either the individual who sold it to you was indebted already, and therefore creditors are going to come after it, or the person who sold to you it sold you the property didn't really own the property. Now, we already proved that it's not a baal chov because peirot are not relevant by a baal chov. So now, who is it? It must be someone who purchased from a gazlan. If that's the case, then Shmuel is saying that you do get shevach against the position we saw before in Shmuel, that you're not entitled to shevach in this case. It's a case when the gazlan has karka, has land. In that scenario, even Shmuel will agree. If you remember yesterday when Shmuel said you don't get shevach, we asked, is the reason that you don't get shevach because the two parties didn't agree to it? I mean, that the buyer and the seller did not put recourse for shevach into the document, but if they did put into the document, it would be fine. Or was the reason that Shmuel didn't allow shevach because mechze keribit? It looks like you're charging interest. And that, Rav Nachman said in the end, was the position of Shmuel, that it's mechze keribit. It looks like you're charging interest because the karka disappears because it was stolen. So that's gone from the transaction. All that happened now is that the buyer gave the gazlan money, And now the gazlan is returning money to the buyer, but when he returns the money, he's returning more money than he got. So it's mechzek ribit. The reason it's mechzek ribit is because there's no underlying asset that is here. Since there's no underlying asset, you can't deem it like a transaction, but rather it looks like money went out, money came in, more money came in than went out. That looks like ribit. But in the case where the gazlan has karka, then in that case, it's not mechzek ribit. Because then it really looks like it's transactional in nature. When the buyer bought it from the gazlan, he handed him cash. When the gazlan gave it back to him, he handed him karka. So when he hands him karka back, it looks like he sold him the land. That's what it looks like. He paid him money up front, and then they sold him the land. The fact that the shevach came along with the land, first of all, it's not as noticeable. It's not mechzek ribit, because it looks like he's just selling him back the land. And the fact is that he purchased it before, and the shevach should belong to him because he put the money down much earlier. And so therefore, in that case, it's not mechzek ribit. Are you permitted to do such a transaction to buy and sell on credit where it looks like mechzek ribit when there is underlying karka? Meaning that if you have a transaction where someone pays for a sa'ah, he says, look, I want to buy a sa'ah wheat from you today at today's prices, and then I'm going to hand you the money. You don't have the sa'ah now. You'll deliver it later. When he delivers it later, the sa'ah has gone up in price. And so when he delivers it back, it's more expensive. So that's either it's a mechzek ribit, a bak ribit, in that the price of the sa'ah went up, and it looks like the reason he's giving him back something more expensive is because the guy forwarded him the cash. So he gave him cash up front. Now he's giving him back a sa'ah that is more expensive. So he's giving out more money than he actually purchased up front. So that we say is problematic in terms of ribit. So now what Abaye says is just because there's karka here, all of a sudden he becomes permitted to do such a thing? Where it says, that's not a problem. The difference is whether it's a loan or it's a transaction. In the case where he buys the sa'ah, but the guy doesn't have what to deliver now, then he basically is lending him money. He's giving him money now, and he's getting repaid at a later date with the delivery of the goods. So that is a case of sa'ah b'sa'ah, but it's a halva'ah. Basically, he's lending him the money. On the other hand, here, it's a purchase. He purchased land up front. That land was confiscated, and now he's getting another replacement for that. He's getting another land replacement. So when you're dealing with a halva'ah, when you're dealing with a loan, that looks much more like a problem of ribit, because you're handing money with no asset in return. You're getting an asset later where the price went up. It looks like ribit. On the other hand, when you purchase land up front, then the land is confiscated and replaces it with another piece of land, that already is zvine. That looks like a transaction. And by a transaction, we don't worry about mechzek ribit, because then it just looks like buying and selling. That doesn't look like you're charging money interest for leaving money with this individual. Igad Amri, I'm Rav Yosef. Hachamayiskinan kagon shukana miyado. It's a case where he had a kinyan, a physical kinyan over here, to solidify the recourse of the shevach. So then, it wasn't just in the contract they wrote, you have recourse for principal shevach peirot. Rather, it's a case where he's made a specific kinyan saying that this kinyan entitles you to any shevach that you put into the property, you can come make a claim back from me. So over here, you are making a kinyan up front on the shevach. So now, Abai asks the same question. Just because you have a kinyan over here, why does that change the dynamic of the fact that you're lending money and getting more back in the end, or possibly getting more back in the end? In the case of Sabasa'ah, you lent him money. You handed him money, got nothing in return, and then you're going to get paid back in the future. That's a halva. Hacha zvine. The fact that you made a kinyan over here is what generates the transaction. It makes it into a transactional type of situation, and there we don't worry about ribit. Now, it's interesting transaction because you have to believe that it's a kinyan on a davar shelo bali olam. It's something that's not in existence yet. You're making a kinyan on the future shevach that's there. But when you buy the property, you're basically giving him money. And in that purchase price, you're subsuming the property itself plus any future shevach that you're going to put in there. And that's what the kinyan involves. So the mecher, the sale, involved the property plus the shevach up front. And that's why it's a transaction. And as Rashi notes over here, Shekonami Yodo means Kodim Sheyesh Shkar Hamtanat Maot. The Kinyan takes place before there's any time to elapse, which means that it's not interest because the Kinyan or the finalization of that transaction took place before he left the money with him to accumulate or accrue interest. And he is basically for purchasing that value or that recourse for the Shevach. The Tosfah points out, Bim Tomar, Im Kena, Mai Kamar, Imlich. Why do you have to actually have the sofer check if he wants him to document this? Halo stam kinyan l'ktiv almeit. They made a kinyan, then the default status is when you have a kinyan, that's included in the document. So why does the sofer have to check whether they want it in the document? It's an event that took place, he should document it. Yishlamar ani mila kagon shikne lo davar shu be'en. That's only true when you acquire something that is in existence now. And when you acquire a tangible asset, then we say the sofer doesn't have to check. He can document that without asking any questions. On the other hand here, the kinyan is on davar shalom al olam. It's about a future shevach that will be there. So now you have to ask the question. That's not automatically for documentation. You have to check if they want that document. All right, now gufa, amar Shmuel, balchov goveta shevach. Now we have this statement of Shmuel that a balchov is able to take away the shevach. The creditor can come along and confiscate shevach from the party that purchased the property from the debtor. He can not only take the property, he can also take the shevach. That's what over here points out, and when we say, Bal gechov govet a shevach, nireh, the gavi afilu min a shevach shishpichu yutomim. That when your balchov is entitled to take shevach, that's not only from a normal transaction, but even in case of yutomim, who inherited the land from their father, they improved the land, the creditor has a right to go after that shevach. Generally, you do not have a right to go after Yitomim. Yitomim, you can only go after things that you had a lien on prior to the father's death, because then the lien continues into the hands of Yitomim. But you can't go after the Metaltalim, or the value that the Yitomim created. But over here, Tosfot says that when you creditor is allowed to go after the Shevach, then that is even from the Yitomim, because even though they have no recourse against anyone, they can't go make a claim now, they are out their money, nevertheless, Havelei Kematana. So even though you have no recourse against anyone, the Yitomim, they are considered to be an extension of their father. And just like by their father, you could go after the Shevach, so too after in the Yitomim, you can go after the Shevach. And the Baal Chov can take that Shevach. Amar Rava, Teida, you should know that this is true. Shekach Kotev Lo, because this is the language that is included in the sale document. This is what the Mocher writes to the Lokeach. Ana ikum v'ashve v'adke v'amarik zvine ilein inun v'amalehon ushvachon v'ikum kadamach utzvi zvina denan v'kabil alohi. So this is Aramaic, but it's the Aramaic language that goes into the contract, which basically is the Mocher, the seller's obligating himself in recourse to the buyer. If the buyer has the property taken away from him, that the mocher will step in to ensure that that doesn't become the case or that he is indemnified for that. Mm-hmm. So this is basically an indemnification, which he says, ikum ashvei. Rashi says means eshkit, which means from the word sheket. Vadkei is from the word tahor. So I will make sure you have a quiet and clean acquisition, which means I will make sure that nobody comes to confiscate the property from you. I will make sure that it remains in your hands. Bamarik zvine ilun inun. And I will, if there is any questions here, I will make sure or ensure that this purchase, it, and any effort that you put into it, ushvachechom, and the value that you created, V'ikum kadamach, and I will make you whole and ensure that it stays in your hands. Utzvi zvina denan v'kabel Elohi. So now, the tzvi zvina, it's hard to know what the translation of it is. Either means that I obligate myself in this manner. That means that the mocher accepts all that's being written over here, which means that he's comfortable with the fact that he is now on the hook for the recourse. Then if you look at the Rabbeinu Chananel, he suggests over here that shibaha kabel alei mocher v'nitratzeh ha-koneh bazeh, that the koneh himself was happy with this arrangement, meaning that he's happy with this arrangement that things could be confiscated from him, and then he'll have recourse against the mocher. So according to some, it's the fact that the seller agrees to the condition of recourse, whereas the Rabbeinu Chanan on others suggests that it is that the buyer agrees to this setup by which he will have recourse, which means that obviously there's a possibility that it could be confiscated or taken away from him. So what Rava is pointing out is the fact that there is recourse from the seller to the buyer for shevach means that the buyer could lose his shevach. What is the case where the buyer can lose his shevach? That's in a case where it's confiscated by a creditor. So that means, or the indication is that the creditor could go after the shevach. The Tosfot doesn't exactly like how I'm framing it. The way I'm framing it is that, well, you see from the fact that the mocher guarantees to the lokeach that he'll cover his shevach, that means, or that shows that the Baal Chov, the creditor, has a right to confiscate the shevach. Otherwise, why would he have to indemnify him for the shevach if there is no way that the creditor could take the shevach? So that seems to be that the language indicates that the creditor has rights here, and that's why he's indemnifying him for that. Tosfot says, in the faresh, tachi de muchach, the Baal Chov govet the shevach. The Bishvil Baal Chov govet the shevach, kutei mocher lokeach, shishalem lo et the shevach. Don't explain like I just said, that the reason that he has to write the indemnification is because the Baal Chov can come take it. The Yishlamar, mid the shalmeim mocher lokeach et the shevach, in the chushi migvo Baal Chov mimenu deina lokeach mafsid. He says it's rather the other way around. The fact that the mocher indemnifies the koneh for shevach makes us less worried about the creditor taking it, because in the end, he will not sustain the loss. So it's not that the documentation is a proof of the fact that a creditor can go after the shevach, because you see in the document that he's indemnifying him for the shevach. Rather, it's the other way around. The fact that we know that he's indemnified for the shevach makes us less worried about the creditor taking the shevach, because in that case, we know that the lokeach will not lose out. He has recourse against the mocher for that amount. So it's not the actual writing or the language that's used here that proves it, but rather the way that these documents are structured and the indemnification of the shevach makes us less worried about allowing the Baal Chov to take more, because in the end, the lokeach will not be the loser. If the creditor was taking more and the lokeach was going to lose out, then we'd have serious reservations about allowing the creditor to do this. But here, where he has an indemnification from the seller for the shevach, then we are more willing to allow the Baal Chov to take more, and that's what the case is here. We'll allow him to take the shevach because we know that the lokeach has recourse against someone. And that's what you see in the language that's written here. The fact that he was indemnified gives us more room to work with the creditor. So now the Gemara says, Amalei Rab Chia Bar Avin the Rova, Elamiata Matana, what about a gift? To Loktiv Lehochi, doesn't have this language in it. Meaning that when you give a gift, the gift doesn't come with this type of recourse or indemnification inside of it. Hakanami de lo tarif shvacha. So in that case, the creditor would not be entitled to shevach. Amalein says, you're right. You're telling me that a gift is a stronger type of ownership than a purchase? Amalein yafeh v'yafeh says, yes, and it is better and better. I mean that this is not the only area where matana gets an upper hand over a mecher. Generally, you would assume that a person who actually puts out money and buys or purchases a land, he would have a stronger claim on the land, and others who come to take it away from him would have a harder case for taking it away from him. Another than a matana, which was given to this person without any remuneration, then that person should have less rights. So what Rav Chia Ba'avin is surprised about, and is what he's questioning Rav about, is, how could it be here that the person who got a gift has more rights than a person who purchased it? The person who purchased the property will lose his property plus the shevach to the creditor. And then the person who got it as a gift will lose the underlying property, but he won't lose the shevach. That makes it a little bit counterintuitive. The matana has a stronger position. The recipient of the matana has a stronger position than the purchaser of the property. In the end, Rava says, yes, that is the case. And this is not the only case where it's true. For instance, Dina de Bar Metzra. Dina de Bar Metzra, which is that the neighbor has a first right of refusal to purchase the property. So if an individual sells their property, the neighbor, if he's willing to match the price, can buy the property and gets a first right of refusal because he's willing to match the price. And it makes sense to give it to him because he has adjacent property, which would make a lot of sense. That Dina de Bar Metzra is only applicable by a mecher, by a sale. But by a matana, it's not applicable. So you see there are other dinim where the matana has a better position. In our case, the reason the Matan has a better position is actually because he has a weaker position. That is because he is not indemnified for the Shevach. That makes it that we won't allow the creditor to take the Shevach away from him because he has no way to get it back. He has no recourse in that case. So his lack of recourse actually gives him a benefit in the fact that the creditor now is not entitled to take it from him because he will be at loss. He will lose that money and nowhere to get the claim for it. So since he has no address for a claim, we don't allow the creditor to take it away from him. On the other hand, by the Mecher, where he does have an address for the claim, he can go back to the seller, there we will let the creditor take away the Shevach because he has an indemnification which will protect him. Right, so Amar Rav Nachman, Hamatz Nita Misaylei Demar Shmuel. This Braita is supportive of Shmuel's position. And Rav Huna explains this Braita in a different manner, which makes it that it's not a proof to Shmuel. Titania Mukhersa de la Chaviro, someone sells a field to his friend, and now it's being confiscated, meaning that the Beit Din is coming and taking away or foreclosing on this property that he bought. In that case, when he goes to collect, meaning that he wants recourse for that which was sold to him, for the principal amount, for the karka itself, he can go after encumbered property of the seller. But for the Shevach, he can only go after free and clear property. And here, the case is a case where it was a creditor that's coming over here. How do I know it's speaking about a creditor? Maybe it's speaking like a gokeach min gazlan, someone who bought it from a thief, where you'd have the same scenario as well. And that would be supportive of Rav's position that you have a right to Shevach in that case. And that's what Hunan Chavrin Mukim Lab Emilia Achrina, but Lokeach Mina Gazlan. He says that it's a case where you bought from the Gazlan, and when you bought it from the Gazlan, the buyer has entitlement to Karen and to Shevach, which is the Shita of Rav. Rav Huna, who is a Talmud of Rav, explains the Braita in a way that is supportive of Rav's position, which is in a case where you buy from the Gazlan, you have a right of recourse, both about the principal amount and the Shevach. And then, the same is true by Rav Nachman. Rav Nachman, who is a Talmud of Shmuel, explains the Braita in a way that is supportive of Shmuel. And he explains the Braita to be speaking about a Baal Chov, about a creditor. And a creditor has a right to grab the Shevach, but in the case of a person who bought from a Gazlan, you have no rights to the Shevach. So he explained the Braita in a case of Baal Chov. Now, how does Rav Nachman say this is supportive of Shmuel, when there's an equally plausible explanation for the Braita in the hands of Rav Huna that says that it's talking about a lokeach min gazlan? And that actually would be difficult for Shmuel. It would actually be against the opinion of Shmuel. The fact that the Braita only mentions the right to Shevach and not to the right to Peirot favors Rav Nachman's explanation. Because remember, we just said before that Shmuel says a Baal Chov, a creditor, is entitled to Shevach, to confiscate the principal, the property, the Shevach, but not the Peirot. The fact that the Braita mentions only Shevach and not Peirot, that gives me an indication we're talking about a creditor and not the Lokeach Min HaGazlan. The absence of Peirot in the Braita is what makes Rav Nachman think the Braita is supportive of his Rebbe Shmuel and not to be explained like Rav Huna explains it. Obviously, Rav Huna can explain it either way. He can explain it like the Baal Chov, but he can also explain it like Lokeach Min HaGazlan. He explains it like Lokeach Min HaGazlan. The reason, as Rashi notes over here, the Nigzal Vadai Tarif Shvacha, Damar le Arai Ashbach. The Nigzal definitely has a right to take Shevach because he says, I improved the property. For the Baal Chov, as long as you haven't taken away, it's not his. Ubershuta de Lokeach Ashbach. And therefore, in the hands of the purchaser, it went up in value. The reason Rav Huna explains it as a Lokeach Min HaGazlan is, he thinks that a creditor is not entitled to Shevach necessarily, only a Lokeach Min HaGazlan is. The reason being, the creditor has rights to go and collect. His lien or his right is on the property, but until he forecloses on the property, it's not his. Until he actually takes and confiscates the property, it's not his. That means that if the buyer improved the property in the meantime, the Shevach should stay with the buyer because the creditor never had a right to that. He shouldn't be able to confiscate that. On the other hand, person who buys from the Gazlan, and then the Nigzal comes to take his property back, in that scenario, the Nigzal has a right to the Shevach, because Karka ain't a Nigzalit. You can never really steal karka. That means that the property was always in the hands of the nigzal, not literally, but figuratively, he is the owner of the property. Then when the buyer improved the property, he basically improved the nigzal's property while he owned it. It's the equivalent of a yorei letoch shdei chaveiro, someone who descends into his friend's field and all of a sudden does all these improvements in his friend's field. Over there, of course the friend gets to keep everything that he did because who told him to go down there and do that? Who told you to go improve the property? That's the same thing here. The lokeach is improving the property, but he's improving someone else's property. So since he's improving someone else's property, the nigzal himself can keep whatever shevach's there. As we noted before many times, Rashi says over here that you get back, and we'll see it in the Gemara in 1 second, you get back the yitziot. The nigzal has to give the lokeach his expenditures, the lower of his expenditures of the shevach, because he can't just say, oh, everything happened by itself. I mean, there was an investment over here. The investment he has to give back. The shevach, he can say, my land did the shevach. My land created the excess value above the investment. But the investment itself, he will have to pay back to the lokeach. So over here, the reason that Rav Huna explains it as a lokeach min a gazlan is for two reasons. One is that his Rebbe Rav says that the buyer has recourse against the shevach from the gazlan. And so the fact that he has recourse against the gazlan makes it that we're not worried about him losing it because he has recourse, and therefore will allow the nigzal to take it. But even legally, the nigzal has more rights to shevach than a bal chov, than a creditor. The nigzal has rights to the shevach because it's his land all the way through, and any improvement was done on his land. A bal chov is not entitled to the shevach because the bal chov didn't own the land till he foreclosed on it. That means anything that was done in the interim didn't belong to him. And so for that reason, Rav Huna says, I think a gazlan, in the case of gazlan, that the nigzal can go after the shevach because it's his shevach. The bachov can't go after the shevach because it's not his. He didn't foreclose yet on the property, and the property remains with the buyer until he forecloses on it. For that reason, Rav Huna explains the braita as being a case of a lokeach min a gazlan, and we're going to explain why Rav Nachman did not accept that explanation because of the fact that it says shevach and not peirot, and it should have included peirot if we're talking about the nigzal. Alright, so now, Tani Yidach, we have another braita that says, Mechesta dele chaveiro bishbicha. Person sells a field to his friend and he improves it. Ubabo cho betarfa. And now a creditor comes and grabs it away. Shukove, ima shevach yoter leitzia. If the appreciated value is more than the investment put in the property, notel te shevach mi balakarka. He takes the shevach from the owner of the land, beyitzia mi balchov. And he takes the yitzia, the expenditures from the balchov. So this is what we just mentioned, is the fact that when the creditor comes to confiscate the property from the buyer bought the property, the creditor has a lien on it, the debtor didn't pay his debt back, now the creditor goes to foreclose on that property. He can confiscate it from the buyer. When he confiscated it from the buyer, we just said now he gets the property plus the shevach. When he gets the shevach, we said that he has to compensate the buyer for his expenditures. So what we say is that the buyer has recourse for the expenditures from the creditor. He has recourse for the shevach from the seller to him, or from the debtor. Which means that he has two parties now who are going to pay him for that shevach. The underlying investment that he made, that the creditor is not entitled to, because he can't just say, that's my land that did it, or that he didn't make expenditures, it just happened. No, it didn't just happen. Somebody invested in the land. That amount of investment, the creditor doesn't have a right to. And so he has to repay the buyer for that amount. He'll get the excess amount above the investment that it appreciated, but he doesn't get to keep the investment without actually paying for the investment. Now, once he's paid for the investment, the buyer is still out money. He's out the underlying karka. He's also out the shevach, meaning the value that was created above and beyond his investment there. Those two pieces, he goes after the debtor for. So that's it. We'll split the din or bifurcate where his collection. He can get the yitziot, his investment monies from the creditor, or basically the creditor will have to take less land or either compensate for him in cash. Whereas the shevach, the increased value that is above the investment, that he can go after only the debtor for it, yet the creditor gets to keep as part of his foreclosure. That's only when the appreciation exceeds the value of the investment. But in a case of yitziah yitera l'shevach, his investment exceeded the appreciation of the value in lo yotza'ah shir shevach mi bal chov. Then he only gets from the creditor the investment, but only the investment amount up to the amount of the value increase. So if he invested $100 or 100 shekel in the property, and the property's value went up only by 50, then the creditor just pays him the 50 and says, take your 50 and I'm done. Because you can't force the creditor to pay him more than the value increase in the land. You can only make him pay up to the increased value. And that's what we always say. It's the lower of his expenditures or the improvement in the value of the land. And over here, the 50 is the lower of those two. And therefore, you can make that claim from the creditor. And he'll get his quote-unquote investment back, but his investment up to the value that he created. Again, when the value exceeds his investment, then he'll get the investment from the creditor and the increase in value or the excess value from the debtor. V'ha-shmuel b'may mukimla. What exactly is the scenario here according to Shmuel? Ibalokech migazlan. If it's a breiter, you're going to explain it in a case where he purchased it from a gazlan, kasha resha. Then the resha is a problem because Shmuel told us before that a person is not entitled to shevach when he buys from a gazlan. He's entitled to principal, he's not entitled to shevach. Damar Shmuel lokech migazlan le shevacha. Ibalchov. If you say we're talking about a creditor here, kasha resha v'seifa. There are two problems with this breita. Damar Shmuel b'chov goveh to shevach, that a creditor is allowed to take the shevach. He's allowed to take the shevach without any compensation. That's the first thing that we learned before. So now, number one, you have a problem with the fact that he has to actually make an outlay here. He has to pay for it. Whether it's when the shevach exceeds the yitziah or is below the yitziah, he's paying the lower of the shevach or the yitziah. Both of those Shmuel never mentioned. When Shmuel said you confiscate the shevach, it sounded like you confiscated it, the creditor took it, without any compensation, without having to make any payment. And all the recourse was against the seller of the property or the debtor. Ramar says, Ibayitema, Pelukeach min a gazlan. Some explain it in a case where he purchased it from a gazlan. Kagon sheesh lo karka. In a case where he has land. Inami bishikanu biyado. Or he had a kinyan up front. Remember we said before that Shmuel's resistance to paying shevach when you bought from the gazlan was its mechzei keribit. And the Gemara before said you could overcome that problem if either the gazlan has property and the recourse is now being taken from property, then it doesn't look like mechzei keribit. It looks like a transaction. It's not a problem. Or in a case where you made a kinyan up front on the recourse for the shevach, if you make a specific kinyan for that up front, it's as if you bought the value of that recourse up front, and it's a transactional, it's like a transaction and not like a borrowing. So basically, or the way that you're doing it is you're basically discounting the property's value, and some of that value that you bought in the property is going towards the shevach, or the recourse for the shevach. So when you paid the money, you paid a portion for the property and a portion for that insurance, basically, that you're going to get the recourse for the shevach. You purchased them both up front. And then now, when you're going back to get it, it's not mechzei keribit, because it was kanami yodo. So both of those would solve the problem for Shmuel, because it's no longer mechzei keribit. In that case, he says the buyer has a right to go after the gazlan for the shevach. Ibai dema b'achov, some explain the bread as being a b'achov, lo kasha. Kan b'shevach ha-magia l'ketfayim. Kan b'shevach she'enu magia l'ketfayim. It depends on what type of shevach you're speaking about. Is it shevach that gets to the shoulders, or is it shevach that doesn't get to the shoulders? Now, we had this Gemara back in Baba Kama, and there in Baba Kama, we saw numerous explanations as what Magila Ketfaim is. Rashi over here says, shevach HaMagila Ketfaim over here is karov li katser. It's very close to being harvested. Elisha, dayin tzrichim the karka. They still need the land a little bit. Havilo kepeirot gmurim. They are equivalent or similar to fully ripened and finished peirot. There the Baal Chov has no right to take them unless he gives him back the investment. Meaning that the more the item is connected to the land, the more right the creditor will have to take it. The less connected it is to the land, the less right the creditor will have to take it because his lien is on the property. His foreclosure is on the property. So the more it's connected to the property, the more right of foreclosure you'll have. The less connected, the less. So Rashi over here says that it's a Magila Ketfayim over here is that if it's already pretty far along in its ripening process to the point where it just needs the land a little more, but it's not fully finished, that already is considered to be separate from the karka, and the creditor can only take that if he reimburses for it, or at least the expenditures for it. If it's already still dependent on the karka in the growing process, there the creditor gets to take it because we consider it part and parcel of the land. That's the way Rashi explains it over here. Rashi in Baba Kama says that way, peirot gmurim, fully finished or ripened fruits are items that he's not allowed to foreclose on. Things that are still dependent on the land, you can collect from because they're still dependent on the land, he can foreclose. The Tosafot over there brings alternate explanations from the Rabbeinu Tam and others that Shevach and Megillah can find. One of them is the possibility that it's anything that you would carry off the land. Anything that you would pick up and carry off the land, that is considered to be Shevach and Megillah could find. But that means that you can currently do it. And you can see that in the Rabbeinu Chanan now here. He says, Vaskinen afilu Shevach and Megillah ketvayim, gon anavim shigyuli batzer, v'kamali katzer shigyuli talem biktefo v'latzeit. Kevin shadayin kekarkahein akol notlim balcho b'chobo. These are things that you can carry off on your shoulder, things that can be walked off the land now because they're at a point in time where they're so mature that they're ready to be hauled off the land. Or there, the Baalei Tosafot seems to indicate even if it's in an earlier stage of growth, in the end, you're going to take this off the land. That's not considered a part of the land. So if you put a tree on the land, you're not walking off with the tree. So that tree becomes a part of the shevach of the land and it will go with the foreclosure. On the other hand, the fruits of the tree, those are things that you will pick and take away from the land. Therefore, those fruits are yours and he can't walk off with the fruits. No matter what stage in the process of growing they're in, those are considered to be separate from the land. That's one possibility. The other possibility, he says, that ketfayim come from to work. You know, how do you put your shoulders into it and you work? Anything that requires your effort or your work is not foreclosed upon or is not part of the land. Anything that happens memela by itself on the land, that is considered to be a part of the foreclosure and the creditor will take it. So those are all different explanations as to what it is. But basically what Shmuel does is differentiate between what type of shevach you're speaking about. Certain types of shevach you're entitled to reimbursement for because they are not considered to be tied to the land or part and parcel of the land. Therefore, the creditor's got to reimburse. There are other types of shevach which are considered to be part and parcel of the land and it comes with his foreclosure. And that's where Shmuel says you have to make no reimbursement. So now the Gemara says, Va masim b'chol yom. Don't we have daily incidents? There we have that Shmuel takes even Shevach HaMagia LeKetfayim. We confiscate Shevach, that which in this case we're claiming that he doesn't have a right of foreclosure. So Shmuel is acting against this differentiation. The Gemara says, Lokasha, Hada Mesik Bei Shur Ara V'Shvacha, Hada Lo Mesik Bei L'Kashir Ara. Depends how much the creditor has a claim for. If the creditor has a claim that exceeds the land and the shevach, Shmuel gives him everything. He says he can take the land, he can take the shevach, no matter what type of shevach it is. His foreclosure covers everything. On the other hand, when his claim is only the size of the land itself and not the shevach, well, when he forecloses on the land and confiscates the land, he gets the shevach comes along with it. It's not something of a choice. So now what's the difference? The creditor has a right to pay him and to remove him from the situation. Because you could have thought in that instance that there are two possible outcomes. Again, where it's his claim exceeds the land and the shevach, he takes everything and the buyer is out of luck. And he'll have to go back to the debtor and be compensated for the recourse that he has with the debtor. That would be both for the land and the shevach. And he'll get nothing from the creditor at all. And that's the case that it says Shmuel collects from a shevach and Megillah Ketfayim. Even things that don't seem so attached to land, he gives it all to the creditor. So that's the din that Shmuel's speaking about. Where is it that Shmuel believes you do get compensated? That's in a case where your claim is only as big as the land. But when you take the land, the shevach comes along. So there are two ways to solve that problem. When you confiscate or foreclose on the property to pay for the debt that is outstanding, you can then foreclose on the property, take everything, the land and the shevach, and then pay back the buyer for the excess that you took. The shevach was in excess of what you should have taken. You'll give him cash for that and you'll cash him out of the situation. That's one possible solution. The other possible solution is you'll take less land. You'll take a certain parcel of land and you'll leave over a parcel of land for the buyer. That excess parcel of land, which is above and beyond your claim, you'll leave that for the buyer because you've now confiscated land with shevach, which is in excess of your needs. So you'll have to leave him a piece of land behind. What Shmuel's din says is the buyer doesn't have a right to ask for land. The creditor has a right to confiscate and reimburse. So in the case where he's entitled to the whole claim, he doesn't have to reimburse at all. In a case where he's taking an excess of his claim, he gets to take everything and pay him cash and cash him out. The buyer has no rights to a claim on the land at all. So that's what the Gemara says here. D'yoyle shvachei umisalikle. He gives him the shevach, he cashes him out, and he basically removes the buyer from the property entirely. That works well according to the one who says that if the buyer has cash, then he cannot remove the creditor. The creditor comes to foreclose here on the property. Now, the buyer of the property says, listen, I know the reason that you're coming here is because you had this debt outstanding and you were expecting to get repaid. You didn't get repaid. I have cash. Instead of taking the land here, I'm going to cash you out. I'm going to give you the money that you would have gotten for this. Does he have a right to stop the foreclosure by paying cash to block the foreclosure? There is an opinion that says, no, you do not have the right to do that. The creditor has a reverse lien here. He can make the decision. He can take the land if he wants, or he can take the cash. You can't force him to take the cash. In that case, I understand why now that the creditor, when he confiscates the property or forecloses on the property, he can take everything and then cash out the buyer and say, too bad, I took everything and cashed out because the buyer has no rights here. According to the one who says that the buyer has a first right of refusal, which basically says, instead of taking the property, I'm going to pay you for the property. I'm going to buy it from you and give you the cash, which is what you want anyway, because you lent money. You were expecting to get cash back. So he has a right to remove the creditor. If I had cash in my hands, I could remove you from taking the land in its entirety. You would have no rights to take this land. Right now, I don't have the cash to cash you out of the whole land. But he should be able to demand, give me a parcel of land inside of this plot that is equal to the shevach that you're taking that you're not entitled to. So he should be able to demand karka because he's really the one who has the first right to the karka. The question in those two opinions is, who is the first right to the karka? According to the one who says that you don't have a right to pay him off, he says that the creditor has the first right to the karka and the buyer is subject to whatever the creditor wants. Now then, if you believe that the buyer has the first right to the land and the creditor can only take it if there's no other option, then in that case, the buyer could cash him out. If that's the case, the buyer should also, in this case, demand land for the shevach that he's overtaking. So, it's a case where the creditor made this directed collateral for the loan. When you use directed collateral over there, the creditor has rights that cannot be removed even if the buyer cashes him out. Meaning that no matter whether you think by a regular case you can cash him out or not, in the case where it's directed collateral, the creditor has super rights over the land, and the buyer who bought the property in the interim has no rights whatsoever. So in our case here, where it's an aputuki, then you don't have any question that the creditor can say, too bad, I'm taking everything, the land and the shevach, even though it's more than my claim, and I'll cash you out for the excess amount. You have no rights to the land whatsoever. Tosafot points out that in the case of an aputuki, you could actually go back now and say, even in a case where his claim is equal or exceeds the land and the shevach, that he still has to pay the shevach. Because what an aputuki does, or directly the collateral does, is it puts into the possession of the baal chov, the creditor, much earlier. If you remember what we said with Rashi before, is that the baal chov doesn't have a right to the land until he forecloses. The reason being is because this guy has a swath of assets, and he's got to foreclose on a particular asset. Till he forecloses on that particular asset, we don't know what he has, or he hasn't have title to it. He hasn't gotten it. On the other hand, when you give him directed collateral, we know exactly where he's going to get it from. And it's almost as if he owns it up front. It's almost as if he's foreclosed on it from the start. If that's the case, this becomes equivalent to a yorei letoch shtei chaveiro. It's a case where you go down into your friend's land and you invest in the land without his permission. Over there, the owner of the land has to pay him the lower of the increased value or of the yitziah. That'll be the same thing here too, which is that even if the claim of the creditor is big enough to exceed the land and the shevach, nevertheless, he will have to compensate in this case, even according to Shmuel, because it's an aputuki. And an aputuki makes it as if he owns the property. And that means that the buyer who bought it from the debtor was really going down into the creditor's property and making improvements. In that case, the creditor has to pay him the lesser of the investment or the shevach. So that's how Tosafot says we could actually backpedal from that previous distinction that we made before. As Rashi notes over here, the reason that the Breita expressed it in the form of Yitziah, and not just saying that he gets to a rebate in cash of the amount that exceeds the value of the loan, is to teach you the din that when the Yitziah is greater than the Shevach, that you only get pay the Shira Shevach and not the Shira Yitziah. He pays the lower of the investment of the Shevach, so that's why the Breita expressed it as Yitziah, to indicate that that which the creditor is compensating for is the lower of the outlays or the value created when he has to cash out this buyer. All right, now let's continue here. Hikir ba, now a new case. Gemara before discussed the case where the buyer from the gazlan was an innocent party. He had no idea that the land was stolen. He bought it from the gazlan, not knowing that the gazlan did not have title to the property. What happens in a case of hikir ba, sheino shalo v'lakha? He knows the item is a stolen item, and he purchases it despite the fact that he knows that it's stolen. Basically, he fails to buy it in good faith, which is really the test under the law today in secular law, which is, when you bought it, did you buy it in good faith? Meaning that you assumed that the other person owned it, you did reasonable due diligence, and you didn't know that it was stolen. Had you known that it was stolen, then you're not buying in good faith, because you know the fact that you're buying something from someone who has stolen merchandise, whether it's merchandise or land. So here, what happens if he purchases the property knowing that it is stolen? Amar Rav, Ma'ot yeshlo, shevach enlo. So here you have step-down recourse. In the case before, we had no idea, and he was an innocent party. Rav says you get your principal back, and you have a right to the shevach. Over here, Rav says, no, you have a right to your principal, but not your shevach. Meaning that when you go back to claim from the gazlan, you can claim your principal amount back, but you cannot make a claim for the shevach. Shmo amar, afilu ma'ot enlo. Shmo says you don't even get your principal amount back. Now their machloket is, the guy knows it's stolen. When he gave over the cash to the gazlan, what was he thinking? He knows he's not buying it from him because he's not the true owner of the property. He doesn't have title to the property. So when they hands him cash, what does that mean? What is he doing when he hands him the cash? But Mike Miflagay, the Rav Savar Adam Yodei Shekarka Ein Lo, he knows that the guy doesn't own the property. Gamar V'Nata On Lashom Pikadon. He deposited the money with him in the interim. He said, look, you'll hold on to the money in the interim, and then I'll get it back. That's basically what he's saying. Not that he actually said it, but that's the implied nature of the transaction. B'nei Malay, L'shum Pikadon. Why doesn't he explicitly tell him, I want to deposit the money with you? Savar Lo Mikabel. He assumed that the guy wouldn't keep it. So here he was going on vacation. He wanted to deposit the money with someone. So what he does is he buys it from a gazlan, knowing that that's not a purchase. We'll have to see what he does with it in the interim, or what he's thinking in the interim. But in the meantime, I'm depositing the money with this guy to watch for me. And he wouldn't have accepted. If I told him I needed him to watch, he wouldn't have accepted it. I don't know how smart this guy is. He's putting a deposit with the gazlan. So either he may be very smart, and that when you deposit with the gazlan, then you know it's not going to get stolen because you know who the gazlan is. You gave him the money. Or he's not so smart because the gazlan is not someone who's honest. So you deposit the money with him, and who knows if you get it back. But either way, he's depositing according to Rav. Shmuel Savar Adam Yodei Shekarka Ein Lo. Everybody, he knows that the guy has no land. The Gamar V'Natan L'Shum Matana. He gifted it to him. B'nei Malay L'Shum Matana. So why doesn't he say that he's gifting it to him? K'sifalei Milta. He's too embarrassed. The recipient wouldn't accept it as a gift. So he wants to give the gift. So this is a way for him to make it look like it's a transaction and gift it to him. It says, Apligei Ba'achad Zimna. We already saw this machlok between Rav and Shmuel and the Gemara in Kiddushin. Deitmar Mikadeshet Achuto. Someone who tries to generate Kiddushin with his sister. He gives her a ring to generate Kiddushin, or gives her money to generate Kiddushin. Rav Amar Ma'ot Chuzrim. Rav says, you get the money back. Shmuel Amar Ma'ot Matana. Shmuel says, no, the money is a gift. Rav Amar Ma'ot Chuzrim Adam Yodei She'en Kiddushin Tofsin Ba'achuto. A person knows you can't marry your sister. It's an illegal marriage, meaning the Torah does not allow such a marriage even to go into effect. And so therefore, when he does that, v'gamar v'natan l'shum pikadon, he's depositing it with his sister to hold for him in the meantime. V'nei melah l'shum pikadon. So why does he tell her that he's depositing the money with her? Savar lo mikabla mine. She wouldn't accept it. She wouldn't watch it. Shmuel amar ma'ot matana. It's a gift. Adam yodea she'en kedushin tofsin ba'achoto. A person knows that kedushin don't go into effect with the sister. V'gamar v'natan l'shum matana. He's gifting the money to his sister. V'nei melah l'shum matana. Why doesn't he say that he's giving it to her for a gift? Ksifa la milta. She's embarrassed. She wouldn't accept it as a gift. So he couches it or covers it up in this kiddushin to make it her feel better about it, as if it wasn't a gift to her. Mar says, tricha, we need both of these machlokot between Rav and Shmuel. To eat mar baha. If it was only in that case by the stolen land, pa'akam arav do avde inish diave matanot l'nuchra. People don't give gifts to third parties, to strangers. He's buying from a gazlan, and now we're saying, oh, he's gifting the money to him. Well, why does he want to give a gift to this person? You give a gift to people either you are close with, or people have done you a tovah. Over here, this is a third party that, why would he have any reason to give him a gift? So over there, Rav says it's a pikadon. But by his sister, maybe he will agree to Shmuel that it is a matana, because there you're dealing with a relative, and it makes sense that he would gift money to his sister. If you only had the case of achoto, in that case, Shmuel says that it's a gift because it is his sister. But in the case of the stolen field that you're buying, maybe you would agree with Rav that there's no reason to assume it's a gift over there. You better to assume it's a pikadon. Therefore, Tzricha, I needed both cases to show me that Rav and Shmuel are consistent in their opinion, both by the case of Mekadesh Ad-Choto and the case of a Koneh Mina Gazlan, someone who's buying from the Gazlan or knowingly is buying from the Gazlan. Ben the Rav Damar Pikadon, Ben the Shmuel Damar Matana. Whether according to Rav who says that you're depositing the money with the Gazlan, whether according to Shmuel they give him as a gift, Hai La'ara B'mai Kainochit. This guy who is going down to use the land in the interim, what is he thinking? Now, obviously, he's trying to be honest because he wants to pay for the land. He's giving money for it. But he knows the land is stolen. So now when he goes down to the land, what justification does he have to go into this land and use it if he never compensated the Nigzal, who is the owner of the property? What's going on in his mind that allows him to go down or feel justified in going down and working the land? Uperot hecheochel. And how does he eat the produce of that land? Again, all of it is stolen. What gives him the right to do that? It's a savar. This is what he's thinking. This is how he justifies him to himself. Ana echud ara v'aved. I'll go down into the land, work it. Ve'echol begaveh. And I will eat whatever the produce is. Ke'echidava kavidihu. The same way that the Gazlan would have done. Listen, the Nigzal wasn't getting the property back anyway. It was going to be in the hands of the Gazlan. So why does it make a difference if it's the Gazlan who's working the property and eating from it, or I'm working the property and eating from it? Either way, the Nigzal's not getting anything. So it may as well be me instead of him that is getting that benefit. So then when the owner of the land shows up, Zuzai Navu, I'll give him the money. The Rav Damar Pikadon Pikadon. According to Rav, who says that it was a deposit. I'll give it as a deposit. The Shmuel Amar Matana, Matana. Shmuel says that it's a gift. It is a gift. Meaning that the money that he gave to the Gazlan, he views that deposit with the Gazlan almost as like a future down payment to the Nigzal. And he basically says, listen, I gave money to the Gazlan. I'm using the land. And the Gazlan would have used the land. So better me than him. And in the end, we'll make sure that the money gets to the Nigzal. Because either in the interim it's a pikadon with the Gazlan, or it's a matana with the Gazlan, but when the owner shows up, we'll get that money over to him, because it'll go from the Gazlan, who doesn't have rights to it, over to the Nigzal. And so in the end, I will pay him. That's basically his thought process, which is, right now I can't get it to the Nigzal, but in the future, if he comes to get his property back, he'll get the money that I gave to the Gazlan, will now go to him, and everything will be fine. But that's how he, in his mind, talks himself into thinking that he's justified in using the property and the produce of the property. Amar Rava. Now we have a conclusion to this sugya. We had many different cases along the way with machlokot. Here Rava comes to pass an halacha. Number one is hilchata yesh lo maot v'yesh lo shevach afu pish lo perish lo et shevach. In that first machlokot between Rav and Shmuel, in a case where he is an innocent buyer of the property from the Gazlan, in that case, he has recourse for both the principal amount and the shevach, like Rav. So he's basically paskening like Rav. Hikir ba she'ena shalo. Our case over here, where he knows it's hot item. He knows that it was stolen. There, v'lacha, and he buys it. Ma'ot yeshlo, shevach einlo. He gets the principal amount back. He's not entitled to any shevach. So that is again like Rav, who says that you're entitled to your principal back from the Gazlan, but not the shevach. Achrayut ta'ot soferi. Who? When there is no lien or recourse in the document, that's a mistake of the sofer, of the one who wrote the document. Ben bishtari alva, ben bishtari mekach chomemkar. Doesn't matter whether it is a loan document or a transaction. Again, in the loan document, it will be a lien. There should have been a lien in the document for the creditor. There's no lien mentioned in it. It's as if it's there because that is a mistake of the sofer. In the case of a transaction, the buyer has recourse built into the document, whether or not it's actually documented in there. It's a right of the buyer that is irrespective of whether the sofer wrote it, because the sofer made a mistake if he didn't write it. Nobody does anything without recourse, and nobody does anything without a lien. And so therefore, even if they don't explicitly say it, that is the default situation, the default status, And the Sofer should be writing these things into the document. If he doesn't, it's a mistake. And the reason he just doesn't say simply Allahu Kirav in both these cases is either because the issue of Achariyot Ta'ut Sofer was not mentioned by Rav, but rather by Shmuel, or because even in Rav's statement, he makes an additional qualification, which is, even if the parties didn't mention the recourse on the Shevach, it is still a part of the transaction. Baimine Shmuel me Rav. Shmuel asks Rav, Chazar v'lachami ba'alim ha'rishonim mahu. If he goes back and purchases it from the original owners, what is the din? Meaning that you have the original owners, the gazlan, who stole it from him, so the original owners are the nigzal, and then he sells it to a buyer. Now this is in a case where shelo hikir ba, it's a case where he doesn't know that he bought this hot property. Tosafot says here it's a case where he has no idea that it's stolen property, although there are those that suggest that this case can be even in a case where he knows that it was stolen property. And what the gazlan does is he goes and pays the nigzal for the property. He basically rectifies the situation by paying the nigzal for the property that he stole. So now the owner of the property, or the rightful owner of the property now, is the gazlan. But he's only the rightful owner after the transaction that he sold it to the buyer up front was. So the buyer bought it when it was still in the possession of the nigzal, and the gazlan was actually selling it to him as a stolen item. Not that he knew about it, but he was selling it to him as a stolen item. Then the gazlan wants to do tshuva, rectify the situation. He purchases it from the nigzal. Now the rightful owner is the gazlan. So his children come and say, we want our property back. Our father bought this property. We want it back. So they go to the lokeach and say, give us our property back. Now, there are the rightful owners, and he only purchased it after the lokeach bought it. When the lokeach bought it, the gazlan didn't own it. So the lokeach's transaction is a false transaction. It was a transaction based on false premises. So when the gazlan buys it later, that's an after the fact. That's not part of their original transaction. Shmuel says to Rav, what's the din there? What should you do? Amalei, mamachar lo rishon l'sheni, kol zchut shetavo liyado. That when the buyer buys the property from the gazlan, he has all the rights that the gazlan will get. And that the gazlan sold him, any right that I have or will have in this property will go to you. That's how the sale works. The sale works is not only you sold the land, but you sold all the rights that this person possibly could have in that property are also sold to you. So therefore, when the gazlan buys it in the future and becomes the true owner, that right passes to the buyer. And he becomes the true owner of the property. Because now the gazlan has benefited himself vis-a-vis the property. That benefit now accrues to the buyer because the buyer bought it from the gazlan and he gets the title basically. Because now the gazlan bought it from the nigzal or the original owner. He's the owner. That ownership will now transfer over to the buyer from the gazlan. All right, so now the Gemara says, my time, what's the reason that we say that when the gazlan purchases the property afterwards, he has in mind basically the rights that he gains will be given to the one who bought it from him earlier? Why is that true? The reason is he doesn't want to be called a thief. Meaning that he is a thief now, and he sold it as a thief. In order to take away that shame of a thief, he goes and buys it from the original owner. So he's trying to do tshuva. He doesn't want to be called a gazlan anymore. He wants to stand by his word. So in one case, he's trying to rectify his reputation and not be called a gazlan. In the other scenario, he wants to stand by his word that he sold it to this guy. And now if it's stolen property, they're going to come and confiscate it from him. So he's doing it in order to be able to keep up his reputation as a honest seller. So he buys the property so that it won't get taken away from the buyer. My benayu, is there a difference in the perspective of as to why he is buying it? Ika benayu, demit lokeach. It's a case where the buyer dies. Damar necha le delolekre gazlono. Now, I don't want this buyer to call me a thief. The buyer bought it, and he's going to call me a thief because the property got taken away from him. But now, Hamitle, he's dead. He's no longer around. The buyer died. So now I don't worry about him calling me a gazlan anymore, cursing me out. He's not around anymore. So in the one who says he wants to stand by his word or the reputation, then also for the descent, the inheritors of the lokeach, he wants to make sure that the property stays in their hands to stand by his word or by his reputation. So he will buy it to ensure that it stays in the hands of the children of the lokeach. So that would be a nafkamina between them. In that case, when he buys it, does it stay with the children or does it come back to the gazlan? Rashi says, what do you mean? Sof sof, karle b'nei lokeach gazlana. Even if the lokeach died, the children of the lokeach know that he bought the property, and when it gets confiscated from them because it was stolen, they're going to call this guy a gazlan. Doesn't matter that they're the children. They weren't the one who transacted with him, but they know the origins of the land, and they're going to call him a gazlan anyway. So that's not a difference between them. Ella, ika b'nayo demit gazlan. It's a case where the gazlan dies. Manda mar nechle le'nish lo likrei gazlan. Person doesn't want to be called a gazlan. Hamidle, he's no longer around. Nobody's going to call him a gazlan anymore because he's dead. L'manda mar nechle le'leku be'minute. If it's that he wants to stand by his word, hachanami avagav demit nechle le'leku be'minute. Even though he's passed away, he wants to leave a good reputation behind. And so therefore, he wants to make sure that the transaction stands. So therefore, we would assume that his purchase is to the benefit of the buyer, not for himself. It says, so, kari le b'nei gazlana. Wait a minute, just because he's passed away doesn't mean that his children then won't be called the children of gazlan. I mean that there is a problem. The buyer is going to curse him out and call him a gazlan. If he's gone, he's going to call the children of a gazlan. Or basically, you're taking property that's stolen from your father. The difference between them is when he gifts the property. The gazlan stole it from the nigzal, the original owner, gifts it to someone else, and then after the fact, goes in and buys it back from the nigzal. So then, in that case, he wants to stand by his word. He wants his reputation to be stellar. There's no difference between a transaction and a gift. A person wants reputationally to have them go through and to remain intact. So therefore, he will do whatever is in his power to ensure that the gift remains in the hand of the recipient or that the transaction stands. In that case, when he purchases it from the original owner, we assume he's doing it for the benefit of the lokeach, the buyer, from him. In the case there where he doesn't want to be cursed out by the buyer and say, the buyer's going to call me a thief. I lost all my money now because you stole that property. You stole me stolen property. In the case where he gifted it to the person has nothing out of pocket. He loses no money over there. You got a gift, and now the gift was taken away. What's the big deal? You wouldn't have had this anyway. I was generous to you, and I gave you a gift. Now that they confiscated because it was stolen property, okay, you're going to call me a thief? Why should you call me a thief? As far as our relationship is concerned, I only benefited you, and you have no loss here. In the case of a transaction, that's not true. In the case where you have a transaction, in that scenario, then the buyer lost out money. He paid the gazlan for the property, and if he doesn't get him the property or keep the property, then he lost money. There he's going to call the gazlan a gazlan, unless the gazlan ensures that it stays in his hand. So that is a case of a nafkamina. In the case of a gift, do we consider the purchase of the gazlan from the original owner to be for the benefit of the buyer from him? Or do we say it's for his own benefit? So in most scenarios, we're going to say it's for the benefit of the person that he sold it to, because both reasons will line up, which is whether it's because he wants to maintain his reputation or he doesn't want the buyer to call him a gazlan. In either case, they're usually overlapping. And the one scenario where they're not overlapping is when he gifts it to a person, because in that case, the person who received the gift has no reason to call him a thief or to get on his case because he didn't lose any money. On the other hand, if it was a transaction, he would have lost money. The buyer lost money and he would go after him. But if you think it's to stand by his word or to maintain his reputation, then it doesn't matter if he gifted it or if he sold it. He wants to whatever action he took to stand. And therefore, when he buys it for the benefit of the lokeach. Okay, we're going to stop here by the two dots on the top of Tetzayin Amud Aleph.